Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Radio Networks on Sunday, March 25th, 2012. This is episode 860. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by Stamps.com. Print official U.S. postage from your own printer and your own computer with Stamps.com. For a $110 bonus offer, including $55 free postage, visit Stamps.com and use the offer code TECHGUY. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. And it's time to talk about computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, and all that jazz. 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the phone number if you'd like to join in on the fun. 888-827-5536. I know that I say that fast. You don't have to memorize it, because memorize this instead. The website, techguylabs.com. Right on the front page there of techguylabs.com, we've got not only the phone number, but a lot of other useful information, like how to get into our chat room. And I do insist that you go to the chat room. It's not an option. You must. No, you don't. But it'd be nice to have you in there. This is the chat room is the, how do I describe it? You know, in high school, the kids who were too cool for school, they would sit in the back and they'd mock the teacher. And they'd make fun of them. That's them. They're the kids in the back of the class. And yet, they're very handy because most of them are hardcore geeks. They live in our chat room. And they're great for me because if I can't answer a question, which, you know, I mean, look, this is a complicated field. They always know something. They can always help. You'll hear me from time to time on the show say, I don't know, chat room, you got any idea? And they'll figure it out. They're very smart that way. So think of it, really, when you call this show, is you've got a team of 1,000 advisors waiting to jump on your problem and solve it. 8888-ASK-LEO is the number. So if you go to techguylabs.com, you'll see the chat room. You'll see the show notes from 850 episodes. I'm sorry, 859 previous episodes. You will see audio. A link to the video, so if you want to watch, I know it's crazy. Sometimes people, for some reason, like to watch radio shows. It's, you know, just a guy and a mic. But if you want to watch, you can. All of that is at the Tech Guy Lab site. We are redesigning it. Boy, this is an eye-opener. You know, if you're a business nowadays, you have to have a web page, right? I mean, you can't not have a web page. It's like not having a phone. It's not really, seriously. Don't you think when you... When you're looking at a business, even if it's a plumber or contractor, at least for me, frequently, I will go online and look at their webpage. Now, you don't expect that maybe so much with a trade, but I don't know. Even a Pilates instructor, I go and I say, well, let me see what's going on here. Let me see the business. And certainly, if it's a national company, they've got to have not just a website, they've got to have a social media presence, a Twitter handle, and all of that. And it's an eye-opener because these things are not easy. You know, if you're a really big company, well, you just throw money at it, and you know, you got a website. It's not, you know, it's not impossible. Although there is a dearth right now of technical talent, we're seeing this all the time with new companies that Facebook, Google, Apple, and Microsoft have snapped up everybody, and there's no one left for anybody else. Yahoo's entire East Coast research division quit or was fired. We don't know this week. They all had jobs probably before they walked out the door. They probably got a text message or a Twitter tweet saying, you want a job? And it was most of them went to where? Google, Apple, Facebook, Microsoft. The big fight right now is Facebook and Google. Because Google, you know, is kind of cool, hip with it. They give you free food. They've got Segways so you can ride from building to building, that kind of thing. But their stock has been out for a while. You know, it's good. It's strong. But it's not going. Facebook isn't public yet. And if you join Facebook, see, you're going to get some stock grants. And who knows? You could be a millionaire next month or whenever they go public. I mean, so right now, Facebook's got the upper hand. That's how it is in the tech business. It has nothing. It has to do with what the flavor of the month is. Just as it is for, kind of for us as consumers, it is for engineers. And they're such hot demand. If you are a web designer, a graphic designer, a programmer, if you know, especially if you know how to do apps, the Bureau of Labor Statistics estimates that the app economy, you know, these little programs that run on our smartphones, has generated, get ready for this, 466,000 new jobs since 2007, since the iPhone came out. 466,000 new jobs. There aren't enough people graduating from the engineering schools to fill those positions. So if you're a kid, by the way, you might want to, or you might, even if you're not a kid, you might want to think about a career in technology. So it is a real challenge, frankly. It is a real challenge when you're designing a website, because there are people who have hung out shingles, web designer, and companies that do this, and they'll charge you a lot of money, and you're kind of buying them sight unseen. You can look at previous work. It's hard to judge, though, whether you're going to get what you thought. It's a real challenge. We're redesigning the Tech Guy Labs site. And I went with a company I'd used before, so I knew them. Interesting company. I mentioned this before. They don't have a headquarters. They don't have an office. They're all over the world. That's pretty much how it is, I think, nowadays. They're a distributed company. The president lives one place, the chief executive officer another, the chief marketing officer a third. Their developers and designers are all over the place. It's very interesting. They meet online. Maybe they have a Christmas party. I don't know. I don't know if they've ever met in person at all. Welcome to the modern world. And it's very interesting. The process of web design is very interesting, because there are all these kind of philosophies of working nowadays. There's one a lot of programmers ascribe to called agile development. And that's what we're doing. Oh boy, this is agile. The premise of agile is create something quickly, and then iterate. Do it, fix it, do more, get more input, fix it. So get something out there. You'll see this a lot now with new websites as they spring up. Fix it, change it, get it better. Agile, they call it. And in order to have these agile meetings, they have these sprints, these two-week, we're going to work really, 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 really hard for 2 weeks. And then we take a breath, see where we are. I guess that's part of the iteration, the lather, rinse, repeat cycle. And then we have to have these what they call stand-up meetings during this process. So we see the progress every couple of days. We have a stand-up meeting or a scrum, which I think comes from rugby. That's that big huddle in rugby where they're all just kind of massed together as a clump. We have our scrum on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, and each person on the team, the designer, the programmer, the leads, there's a project manager, us, the clients. We all are on conference call, and we're having our stand-up, which means it's short, right? Because you're not sitting down, so you can't enjoy it. No cup of coffee. The stand-up's fast. And then each person presents, and at the end of their presentation, they say, ta-da, to say, I'm done. There's this whole culture around the fact that nobody's in the same room. So you need a signal, right? Otherwise, you could read the body language, or somebody would sit back, they put their pencil down. No, you got to go, ta-da. It's fascinating to watch this. I feel like I'm in a new century, a new world. And, you know, that's just today's flavor of the month. Next year, it'll be something else. We'll say data. I don't know. But it's fun. It's fun, and it's fast, and it seems to be working. So I say all this as a preface to the fact that when you go to techguylabs.com, I know the site looks like it was designed in the 1990s. It was. But it is being redesigned, rejiggered, and it's going to be so great, because it's finally going to have incorporate some participation from you. We're going to create the Team Tech Guy, give you a chance to help others. Those 1,000 people in the chat room who just know so much, they're going to have a place there. And so, wow, Darren Kitchen from Hack 5 is in the chat room. Hello, Darren. Some smart people in there. He does a great show called Hack 5. 8888-ASK-LEO. Go to the website, techguylabs.com. That's all you need to know. It's all there. We will go to your calls. We'll talk. We can talk about the new iPad, the latest Android phones, battery life, whatever's on your mind. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Ta-da!
Oh, hey, I've just been informed that this show is brought to you by Stamps.com. Don't I love that? Let me tell you a little bit about Stamps.com, because I am such a huge fan. I've been using Stamps.com. You know, when I first became aware of Stamps.com, they have a sister service that lets you print stamps with your face on it. And being such an egotist, I immediately arranged for stamps with my picture on it. I thought, this is the closest I'm ever going to get. And that was fun. And then I found out that Stamps.com lets you print postage of all kinds right from your computer and printer. I thought, how can that be legal? But it turns out, yes, it is. The U.S. Post Office not only endorses it, frankly, they want you to use Stamps.com. You know, right now, they're closing post offices. We just learned that two out of the three post offices in Petaluma are going to be closed. The price of stamps is changing, right? And so you just know that the post office does not, they do not want you to come in and get in line. They want you to use Stamps.com. That might be why they give additional discounts to Stamps.com users you can't get at the post office. 21% off on express mail, up to 15% on priority mail. So how does it work? Well, I have it right here. You get the Stamps.com scale. This is a USB scale. So you plug it right into your computer. On a Mac, you go to Stamps.com. There's software pieces for Windows you can download. You put your letter on the Stamps.com scale. It tells you exactly how much postage, and it's always kept up to date, so you never have to guess. You never have to add additional postage. You know, have you ever done that where you put more postage on a package because you don't want to get returned? Well, you're wasting money. So it prints it out, and it's using something called Indicia, so it has a barcode on it. And for that reason, the post office, you know, normally if you just put stamps on a package over 13 ounces, you have to bring it to the post office. Post 911, they want to check you out. Not necessary with Stamps.com. The Indicia has information about your identity, so they're not even worried about it. You can mail packages of any size, postcards, letters, giant packages. And the best part is you don't even bring them to the post office. You put it, the mail carrier picks it up. You can even arrange a free pickup. You just call them and say, I want you to pick this stuff up. So it's really, I mean, it's the ultimate convenience. Here's what you do right now. Stamps.com is the website. Stamps. I don't know. I have to spell that for you. You probably know that. .com. You see, when you first go there, it says $80 value. Don't. No, stop. Click the radio microphone link and use the offer code TECHGUY. I think that's the offer code. Let me check. Yeah, TECHGUY. And then if you see my face, you did the right thing. And notice the $80 went to $110. This is a no-risk trial that includes $55 in postage. The scale is free. You get a supplies kit and a one-month trial. Just clicking that button and using Tech Guy. Please try it today. I think you're going to really like it. Stamps.com. GBF dude in Canada says, I wish they'd do this in Canada. You should petition your government. This is so great. You never go to the post office again. Everything you could do at the post office. International mail, you know, that's always a challenge, right? Mailing something internationally. No problem. They actually have the forms built in. They print out the forms, give you the right postage. You know exactly the amount to put on there. You put it on there, they pick it up. It's just a boon. If you're an eBay seller, you'll love it. Any small business should have Stamps.com. Stamps.com, use the offer code TECHGUY.
Ta-da!
Ta-da! There's nothing like an accordion on a Sunday morning. Hurry, hurry, hurry. Or Sunday afternoon. Depending on your time zone. I feel like the circus has come to town. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888-ASK-LEO. I know, the chat room's telling me what time it is. I apologize. Sometimes, some places, it depends where you live, right? If you're listening in Hawaii, it's morning. California, it's morning. The rest of the world, it's afternoon or evening. That's one of the cool things about doing this show is we're all over the world. Thanks to the internet, and we have listeners in every time zone. The GLAAD fans listening in the UK at 7 p.m. there. Edmonton, Dublin at 7:20 p.m. and Kevin in Dublin. Somebody in Poland, eh? 8:20 or 20:20, as Cassius Casaspelli says, in Germany. I love it. 8888 Ask Leo. The internet is amazing, amazing thing. I'm having trouble as again. I'm sorry, Kyle. I'm going to have to make you go to work here with getting my call screening up. So if you would do me the honor of telling me who our first caller is, Mr. Kyle Benham, ladies and gentlemen.
John in Mission Viejo.
My musical director says John in Mission Viejo. Imagine him in a drum major suit with a baton. And John, you're on. Hey, John.
Hey, Leo. Hey, first of all, Carbonite, I bought it 2 weeks later. My computer crashed, and it was the easiest restore I ever did. So,
aren't you lucky? Boy, talk about good timing.
Oh. It was perfect.
Well, I'm very glad that it worked for you. Thank you for that plug for one of our longtime sponsors and nice guys, too.
So my family is somewhat dispersed. My kids have never met my uncle or my aunt, and we're actually going to have a little family reunion here, but my parents live in Georgia, and we were going to do Skype conferencing, but I wanted to know if there's a way that we could have a video chat that we could record so that we could look back on this later. My parents are getting kind of up in years, and this is going to be a time for them to share their past with my kids, and I'd really like to get a video recording.
Absolutely, absolutely. In fact, you want to record video the whole event, and there are call recorders for Skype. Are you on Windows or Mac? Is I guess the first question.
Well, I'm on a Windows, and they're on a Mac. So
on the Mac, there's a great little program that I've used from the company called Ecamm called Call Recorder. It just attaches to the Skype, records the audio and the video, does an excellent job. It's kind of a generic name, but Ecamm is the company. I think, let me just check. It's ecamm.com. On the Windows side, yeah, ecamm.com. On the Windows side, there are a number of different choices. I've used something called Pamela, and I know others have used that with good results, but there are many other things. So Pamela for Skype, if you go to Pamela, Pamela.biz, you can you can download this, and it will record both the audio, the video, and the chat, which is kind of cool, automatically.
Cool.
Yeah, so the whole thing is recorded for you.
Fantastic.
There's a freeware version that'll record up to 15 minutes, but you're going to talk longer than 15 minutes. So
right.
But it's not very. I can't remember what it is, but it's not very expensive.
Fantastic. Thank you, Leo. Appreciate
you're welcome.
It.
What a great idea. I think that's something you want to absolutely memorialize and remember. Pamela.biz, Pamela.biz. What I would do with both Pamela and Call Recorder, if you're going to do it on the Mac, you want to record it on your side, I think, is download the trial first just to make sure it'll all work for you. And that it does everything you need it to do and it works on your system. In fact, Skype is one of those things that you want to test before. We do a lot of Skype. Almost all of our guests are on Skype on this show and all the podcasts I do. But we almost always will test hours before because there seems to be, for some reason, a lot of tweaking necessary. You got to, sometimes you need to update the software. Sometimes it doesn't work. There's a lot of tweaking necessary. All my engineers here have become experts at manhandling Skype into submission. And that's kind of what you have to do. So don't wait until the big day to test it. I know that's hard. And it's especially hard for older parents. You got to walk them through the process and all that. That's why don't install it on their end. Install it on your end. Be easier for everybody involved. And if you're already making Skype calls, that's a big plus. Let's go to San Juan, Puerto Rico. Bill is on the line. Hey, Bill. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Good morning, Leo.
Morning.
In the late 70s, I built a computer using the RCA 1802 chip, and I had a whopping 1,028 bytes of memory.
Wow. Now, did you do this from a kit, or did you do it all on your own?
No, I got the chip from RCA, and they sent along some schematics. I built it from there. And then later on, I think it was Popular Electronics came out with the ELF diagram.
Right. Wow, you're a veritable Wozniak. You're an engineer. That's impressive.
Well, I didn't do anything with it except put it on my train set, but it was interesting.
Hey, that's fine. You know, it's hobbyists like you and like hams that really got this whole thing started, you know, because they were the only people who were technically savvy enough and motivated to do this. In the earliest days of computers, home computers, personally, you couldn't do anything. So it was only hobbyists who had any interest. I mean, what are you going to do with 1K of RAM? You know, run a choo-choo. That's about it.
You become very good at programming.
Yeah, you got to write all your own software and all of that.
WP4KV8, by the way.
Oh, see, a ham. I knew it. Well, it's nice to talk to you, W6TWT.
My question is, many years ago, when I built this place, I used RGA cable and came up with a 10 base 5 network. Now, I've got one installation that's about 1,500 feet away, and I would like to use that cable with Ethernet, with Cat 5.
Right.
And speed's not really important, it's just the distance. And is there any inexpensive adapters from 10Base 5 to Ethernet cable?
So you're using the 10Base 5 is, if I remember, is like coax cable, right?
Yes, it's RG58, yes.
So what you probably could do is use what's called a balun. And I'm sure as a ham you've heard that term, BALUN.
Sure.
They make balans that will translate Ethernet into coax. So you'd have
everything I found has been over $200.
Oh yeah, they're expensive. They shouldn't be because it's just a transformer. But actually, I'm looking here. I see less expensive. You know where you should probably go is monoprice.com. They seem to have Monoprice is a great website for inexpensive cabling, and I bet you they sell balans as well. So what the balun does is it converts the Ethernet, so it's got an RJ45 on one end, into the coax, and you can then have a long throw on the coax, and then at the other end you have another balun that converts it back.
Great, Leo. I'll give them a try.
Yep,
thank
Bill.
You.
You're welcome. Love you. I'd love the do-it-yourselfers. Everybody should know about Monoprice. Monoprice.com, great place to get cheap gear. Kyle was playing that. It was kind of something that happened off the air. I just got this autographed CD of an interview that was on our network of a guy named Mike Vucelic, who was the guy who received that message, Houston, we got a problem, was on the board at the time. During Apollo 8 and 13, chief engineer of the command module. So he was the guy, in fact, won the Medal of Freedom for helping save Lovell, Swigert, and Hayes. So that's a bit of that's nice. Great. It's fascinating to hear that again. 8888, ask Leo. 1970, that was. 1970. Hard to believe. 42 years ago now. Ron is in Temecula, our next caller. Hey, Ron, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Good morning, Leo. I'm Ron from Temecula. I'm running a Windows XP, and I went to a website, and I could see it was just frantically downloading the virus, and I had a couple pop-downs, run, cancel, so cancel. But anyway, enough got in somehow where when I tried to sign in, wouldn't let me sign in. So I reboot again, go to F8. Try safe mode, and in any case, I cannot get in to retrieve and then run the antivirus.
Temecula, we've got a problem.
Yep.
Not exactly life-threatening, but still pretty annoying.
Yes.
So what you probably want to do at this point is create a boot disk.
Okay.
Because you can't boot, obviously. You can't. Something's gone wrong, and I don't know. Maybe how did you stop the download? Did you just suddenly unplug or shut off the machine?
I canceled out everything and then shut it down. Yeah.
Okay, but you shut it down normally.
Yes.
Yeah, you didn't just like pull the plug out of the wall.
No.
Because that, just the reason I ask is, of course, if the machine is running to the hard drive and you pull the plug unceremoniously, that can cause more damage than the virus itself. But I'm glad. So you shut down as quickly as you could, but, you know, these things happen so quickly. By the time you've noticed that anything's happened, it's a little bit, it's often too late. You've already gotten an infection. So we're going to assume right now that your machine is laden with bad guys. First thing to do, get it off the internet. I hope you have another machine you can work with, but get it off the internet because it's just asking for more stuff. Even though you can't get into it, who knows what's going on. Probably it's all right because you can't get it to boot. But let's not take the chance. Maybe it's booted and it's just not showing you a screen and it's meanwhile downloading stuff or uploading your data. The best thing you can do, once you get an infection, the first thing to do, get it off the internet. Unplug it from your network. You don't want it infecting other computers. You don't want it doing anything else. So it's sitting there now, and now you're looking at it, and it's just it's teeming with beasties. What do we do? Well, you can't boot up. So what you want to do is you want to make a boot CD and boot to that. Now, I hope your machine isn't so old that you can't boot to a disk, an external disk. But I would go to another machine and create a boot disk that will let you at least try, although it's not likely you'll succeed, try to recover what's going on. You can make a Linux disk. Probably what you want is a boot disk. This is something you should usually do before you have a problem, because if you had it, you just pop it in. But since it's already happened, let's go to ultimatebootcd.com on another computer. Maybe a friend or buddy will help you out. And make this boot CD that will let you boot up into it and let you run antiviruses. It'll let you check what's going on. You might want to add, if you can, you might want to add to it things like malware bytes. But this is a great little thing to have. And truthfully, I would do this now if I were you, before you get in this position. It's too late for Ron, but before you get in this position, everybody should have a CD that you can boot from if your computer is modern enough to boot to a CD. Most are. In the last few years, all of them do that. And then boot up that CD and see what you can see. What one hopes at this point is that you can then attach an external drive, copy your data off. You say you're not seeing any files. Let's hope that booting from a known clean operating system lets you copy stuff off so that you've got your backup. Because if you haven't been backing up, what the real risk here is not so much reinstalling Windows, big deal. It's losing everything you've got. So boot up to this Ultimate Boot CD. Copy off what you can. You might want to run an antivirus on it just to see if you can see what's on there. And this has a lot of useful tools for that kind of thing. There's a good free antivirus that also makes a boot disk called FDisk from FProt. FProt. Actually, I think that's the name of the FProt is the name of the antivirus. F-PROT. You can make a boot disk there that is an antivirus, up-to-date antivirus boot disk. But I like having the Ultimate Boot CD because it does so much more. Because ultimately, I think what you're going to end up doing is trying to copy your files off and then find that system recovery disk that came with your computer and wipe the whole thing out. The problem with kind of patching a infected system is you can never be sure you got everything. Most of the time, you don't. And what'll happen, or the worst case scenario, is you think you got everything. Everything operates normally, except, and you don't even know this, in the background, you got a bad guy running. And he's just watching what you're doing. Maybe he's copying down passwords. Maybe he's inviting other people in, that kind of thing. Best thing to do at this point probably is wipe it out. But go if you can get a buddy to do this, get the Ultimate Boot CD. You can get your data off. Then get those system recovery disks or a Windows install disk. Make sure you format the drive. You want to wipe it all out and reinstall Windows. Then restore your data. And then the most important thing after you reinstall Windows is get online with Windows Update. You're going to go immediately to Service Pack 3 on XP and then add every additional fix since then, because what you don't want is a vulnerable computer. That's how you get infected. It's probably what happened in the first place. Peter in Buffalo, New York, you're next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo. How you doing today?
I am well.
That's good. Hey, I've got a question. I'm hoping maybe your chat room can help out, or maybe you would know. Give me the answer here. I have a e-commerce site that's a hobbyist site for amateur astronomers, and cool. I've developed some tutorials that allow amateurs, show amateurs how to develop their or how to process their images. Hmm. And it's been a great site, and we have you can buy a link to stream down the tutorials. We give a lot of free content away too, or you can buy a DVD. And what we'd like to do is put together a site that we could have kind of a create a community with some forums and things, but have different levels of membership. Still give away a lot of free content, but then have kind of an all-you-can-eat type of monthly, membership fee, so they can get access to all the tutorials that we have. And I went down the line starting using Squarespace to rebuild the site.
Mm-hmm.
And I fell in love with Squarespace, but there's no paid membership module.
Ah, let me talk about that in a second. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy.
With new friends and new things to see.
We'll spin you through the galaxy.
On the Great Space Coaster. Oh, on the Great
Space, Coaster. Is that a ride?
Step inside.
That's not my cup of tea. I'd rather go to the moon than ride the space coaster. Oh, I'm sorry. I can't take it. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. We've been talking to Peter in Buffalo, New York. He's using Squarespace, so that's a good start, but he wants to start doing paid memberships. Now, Squarespace does have this audience feature, which is nice, on some of the higher accounts.
But it's strictly a manual, manually updating it, and I'd like something that is will see memberships expire and such and just take them off.
It would be nice to have it be automatic, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Because that's the whole idea of audiences is that, if people have the right credentials, they can see different parts of the site. So I presume that the audience features everything you need except for the automation.
Yes. Payment and such.
Yeah, and I'm looking here, and it doesn't look like, you probably could find a third party providing that and integrate it somehow. But it doesn't look like Squarespace. Let's see. They have PayPal integration.
Yeah, I can actually send people off, but I have to manually then.
This is something they should have, and I'm sure that they're considering it. Let me talk to Anthony and say, hey, Anthony, what's the plan on this? Because they're so close. They're so close. They've got the feature, the audience's feature. But they need, you're right, I don't see any way to do it. And the nice thing about Squarespace is, you've already got all the work done, right? Is it working for you in every other respect?
Yeah, I developed our current site where I developed with Dreamweaver. And, it's nice, but I'm not a developer. I'm a web developer.
Okay? Yeah.
And I just went, and I started using Squarespace, and I got the founder of the site probably 60% done, and then realized that this was kind of a bug on it, and I had to stop the development.
Right. Oh, I got it. So it stalled you out now, really?
Yeah, it really has. We've probably got about 1,000 customers right now, and if everyone went for some sort of membership level on a monthly basis, I'd have to keep track of that, and it would be a nightmare.
Yeah.
So, or is there some other similar type of site that somebody could recommend? I looked at something called Ning, but it wasn't as nearly as nice as
Yeah, Facebook. Ning has an interesting provenance because it was a free. The idea was create your own social network for free, and then they couldn't make it. And Mark Andreessen, who the creator of Netscape, it's his company. He eventually went to a paid site, and I think they lost a lot of business as a result. Here's one that one of our chatters. Is recommending right now. It's called Webstarts, webstarts.com. It looks, to me, this looks like, GeoCities or one of these. Let me see what.
How about Adobe Catalyst? Yeah, I've seen that Adobe.
Yeah.
Adobe has something out.
Yeah, this has a membership feature, actually. Webstarts.com. Let you add a sign up and login link to any page. You'll now be able to have send these memberships. Doesn't look like they're handling the back end, though. That's kind of what you want, is something that will do all the transactions, keep track of everything. You know, Adobe Catalyst is more of a manual solution, I believe.
They do have some templates. They looks like they do have a membership feature. They do have like a month free service like Squarespace gives you. So I think I'm going to look at that and try that out. But I figured I'd go out to you and your audience, and if someone could recommend something.
Yeah, let me take back Web Starts, because after looking at the reputation on mywatt.com, not impressive. That may not be a good choice. Certainly Adobe is a well-known, reliable company. Let me ask the chat room. They haven't come up with anything yet, but maybe they will. Or somebody who's listening, what would be, I understand what you want to do. What's the domain of your site right now? Can we look at it now?
It's www.ip4ap.com. IP4AP.
IP as in I better not.
Internet Peter, the number four.
AP. Oh, this is nice. Peter. You've done a nice job. I'm liking it.
I've started redesigning it, thinking I'm going to be. I had to stay with Dreamweaver, but we have a ton of customers all over the world, and we want to just make it a little more accessible. We'd like to make a little money on the side of it, and you can see by the globe there, you got a lot of people on it right now. So.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, you're so close. Let's ask and maybe somebody in the chat room will have a solution. I don't know off the top of my head, but maybe somebody. Who's listening will call in or visit the chat room and give us some solutions. So we're looking for a hosting company, and I'm telling you, Squarespace is a sponsor, and I'm going to absolutely talk to Anthony. I'm sure that that's on his roadmap. Find out when he plans to add. You know, they're so close because you can have up to five different audiences. That's what they call it, and these people have are given logins, so you could have five different membership levels. You know, free. Going on up, but we need to tie it into a payment system so that it's automated, because the last thing Peter wants to do is say, okay, let me figure out, oh, this person's paid, it's due now, it's overdue. You know, that's just too complicated. This should all be managed. And you'd think somebody like PayPal would have a solution like that. It's a beautiful site. Texas Mike, I agree. Texas Mike in our chat room says, cool astrophotographic site. And I'm just looking to see if anybody in the chat room has some solutions. Nobody yet. Keep watching, Peter. Keep listening. Maybe we'll find something. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Dennis is in Glendale, California. He wants a project manager, maybe some database design help. Well, we're getting some high-end questions today, aren't we? 8888-ASK-LEO, that's the phone number if you have a solution or a question of your own. I'd love to hear from you. Meanwhile, let's remind everybody how important it is to, it's like the match game. I could just say to blank, and you'd probably all say, back up, right? Because you've been listening. You know. Dennis, Glendale, California, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Dennis.
Yes, hi, Leo. My question was regarding if you had a suggestion for a project manager that understands databases. I understand how to create the databases I'm creating using FileMaker Pro for the iOS platform, and have difficulty being able to know how to lay out the project, and a project manager would be the best solution, but I've been told by friends and family that project managers are usually left-brained, where they're creative,
yes.
And database people are usually right-brained, which are technical, and it's difficult, and I've been searching on the Internet.
Do you want one, Dennis, that's online, or do you want one that sits on your computer only?
I was probably looking for someone who was pretty much in person, where I can talk to someone.
Oh, you want a person? I get it. So you need a person to do this for you. I get it. So let me suggest a website called Elance, ELANCE.com. This is a place where programmers, database designers, project managers go to find work. It's really a great resource. 1.3 million professionals online. Elance.com. Well, a good day to you, Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy, Hour 2 of the Tech Guy Show on this Sunday afternoon. 8888-ASK-LEO. This is the number if you want to call in. 888-827-5536. Toll free for anywhere in the U.S., outside the U.S., you can still call and use Skype out. It won't cost you anything. 8888-ASK-LEO. The website, techguylabs.com. And we've got some solutions, some very good solutions, I think, for our astronomy photography guy. He has a website, and he was really interested in having some paid sections of the website. So this is very common. You get a free bit of the site, but then if you want more, you pay a little bit, you may become a member, and you get more. The problem is handling the payments and managing the memberships because, of course, it gets to be a bit of clerical work to keep track of who's paid, when their subscription ran out, what access they have, and all of that. And it seemed like there should be a service to do this, and we found a couple. There is one person in the chat room suggested if you use WordPress on your own hosted blog, there are plugins like WP-Members that will let you do this. But I think the best answer came from a number of people in the chat room. They suggested a website that works with WordPress and others called A-Member, amember.com. And, you know, this makes perfect sense. It just figures that, there's a solution to this. It's membership software that will handle subscription payments, manage customer profiles, integrate with your blog or your forum or your content management system. You can have opt-in newsletters and affiliate program. I mean, it just is perfect. Supports PayPal, ClickBank, WordPay, lots of, online payment systems. And they have plugins for WordPress, Zenfolio, VBulletin. So this seems like exactly what you want. Kind of a cool system, actually. So a couple of people in the chat room have used this and recommend it. Amember.com. There you go. It is true that I may not be able to answer a question, but by the time we can pass it through our chat room, there's no question they can't answer. No question. It's not free, of course. $180 for the pro version. Is that a year? It must be a year. Good deal, though. I think. If you're making money, it's a good deal. Moving along to David in Merced, California. David's next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, David.
Good afternoon, Leo. How are you?
Very well. How are you?
Well, I've got a problem I'm hoping you can help me with. I had a system get infected, wiped the disk, and I'm in the process of reinstalling the software, one of which is Office Pro 2007.
Yeah.
When I tell it to go ahead and install it, I was getting a application failed to initialize properly error. The auto run executive apparently is the problem. But while I'm talking, or while I was waiting to talk to you, I went to the drive and just typed in setup, and it began to work.
Huh.
So now I guess my question to you is this perhaps a sign that the virus is still in the system?
No, it's not unusual. It's an out-of-date Windows installer.
Ah.
And in most cases, Windows Update will fix it. Sometimes you'll have to go to Microsoft.com and download an update on the installer. It sounds like it fixed itself, which is perhaps as part of an update, it fixed itself. So just make sure you have the latest version of the Windows installer. I've seen this many times.
Okay.
Most applications in the Windows world use Microsoft's Windows installer. The current version, I think, is 4.5, but probably when you restored your hard drive, you had an old version. If you Google Windows installer 4.5, Microsoft actually has a standalone download. So if this happens again, I would just download the latest version of the installer and make sure you got that. Thanks for the call. Sorry you got bit. You did the right thing, though. I think that almost always that's the best solution, although the most painful is to back up your data, reinstall Windows, reinstall your apps, restore your data, But you got to remember, as I mentioned last hour, you got to remember when you reinstall Windows, you're installing an older version of Windows. Very important, really, before you do anything else, to immediately go to Windows Update and keep updating till you're done. Keep updating till there's no more updates to get. What those updates do is patch holes that have been discovered in Windows. And the minute Microsoft publishes that update, they're announcing to the hacker community, we've got a problem. So the hacker community jumps on it. They take a look at the patch and reverse engineer it to figure out where the hole is and immediately write software that takes advantage of the hole. And then, this is the part I enjoy, they package it up into a kit and sell it online. So if you know where to go, there are online, mostly out of Eastern Europe, the old Russia and so forth, there are these sites that will sell you hack kits. If you have a, mostly they're intended for website owners. So let's say I have a website that I'm a bad person. I'm an evil person. I create a website that's going to draw a lot of traffic. You can imagine what kind of site that would be. Think of what would draw a lot of traffic. And then without, you know, telling anyone, I go out and I buy one of these hacker kits. They're not expensive, $50, $100. It contains hundreds, sometimes thousands of individual little exploits. They all run in a package behind the scenes. So when somebody comes to visit the website, this little package gets activated and starts to chew away at your computer looking for holes, looking for problems. All of these come from these known exploits. Now, if you've been good, if you've been assiduous about updating your system, all of those holes will be patched. But if you haven't, guarantee you're going to get bit. So that's why when Windows updates, you better do it. And if you're putting a new version of or reinstalling Windows, you better make sure you get all of those updates. So Mad Men is back tonight, right? What is it? A&E, AMC, one of them. And, you know, you could watch it, as many do, on TV. But increasingly, people are either DVRing it, TiVoing it. I kind of made a new word, DiVoing it. They're DiVoing it. Or they're, I think that's good. I like it. I'm going to use that. Not trademarked. Or they're doing what I did, which is I went to iTunes and I bought a season pass so I don't have to remember to record it. And when the new show comes out, it'll automatically download to my computer and I can just watch it at my leisure minus commercials. I think it's $35. It's not cheap. But I get it right away. I get it, you know, the day after the show airs. How much would the, you know, I don't know, but what it's probably less than a DVD or a Blu-ray of that season. It's for the full season. It was about 13 episodes, so that would require maybe two or three DVDs. I bet you it's more than $35. Here's why I bring it up. Just read an article by Dante D'Orazio on The Verge, thanks to the chat room for suggesting it, saying a billion more movies will be streamed this year in the U.S. than watched on DVD or Blu-rays. It is finally coming to pass, as I thought it would, I've been calling for this for some time, that physical media, discs, are dying. More and more computers don't even come with a disc. More and more people are watching movies, television shows, streaming via Netflix. Three or other systems, iTunes, 3.4 billion movies will be legally consumed over streaming services this year. That's double last year. Double last year. 2.4 billion DVDs and Blu-rays, they're dropping 7.7%. It is a sea change in the way we watch and consume content. And you know what? For all of their belly aching about piracy, that's pretty good news. 3.4 billion movies legally watched this year. I think that's good news. 8888 Ask Leo. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Ah, so excited. Mad Men's coming back. It was a long wait, wasn't it? Seems like they ended season 4 ages ago. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 17 months ago. Well, it was ages ago. was ages ago. So we're talking a little bit about the idea of watching stuff. So I could watch Mad Men for absolutely for free on broadcast. Well, I mean, I pay for a cable bill, but it's part of my deal. And I could wait once, you know, and watch it. Or I could DVR it absolutely free. But here's the deal. The convenience of it was worth $35 so that I'd know that I wouldn't, that I'd be able to watch it without commercials, that I'd be able to watch it when I wanted, that I'd have a copy of it. I think that this is the future. The problem is Comcast hates this idea. Because I'm using my Comcast internet to watch streaming movies, but the money's not going in Comcast's pocket. It's going in Apple's pocket or Netflix pocket or iTunes or Amazon. Or what they'd really like me to do is use the on-demand service, right? So I think it's very interesting to see how they fight this. They did something preemptively a year or two ago that nobody thought was a big deal, but is starting to look like a big deal. Comcast, as did many other internet service providers, at least those of them that are in the TV business, put a cap on your bandwidth, 250 gigabytes a month. I think AT&T has 150 gigabyte a month cap. AT&T is also in the TV business. They have this thing called U-verse, right? So, and they said at the time, Comcast said, oh, 250, don't worry about it. Only like 0.1% of our customers use anything close to that. It's okay, don't worry. We're just doing that to protect you against bandwidth hogs. It's not. Now, I'm going to point out a couple of things. First of all, caps don't protect you against bandwidth hogs. Now, this may seem counterintuitive. You might say, well, if somebody's downloading more than 250 gigabytes a month, surely they're a bandwidth hog and they're impacting me. No, because it turns out congestion has nothing to do with the amount you download, but when you download it. The real problem is that everybody's watching Netflix between 7 and 10 o'clock at night. 30% of all internet traffic during prime time is Netflix. That's congestion. And that's what's hitting you. If your bandwidth hog is only downloading stuff at noon and 3 a.m., he's not impacting you at all. And in fact, a lot of people who use BitTorrent and other big downloading programs have set these programs to work on off-peak times because they get faster downloads. And because they want to be good netizens. They don't want to congest your network. The truth is the people who are really bugging you are your neighbors who, like you, are watching Netflix at 8 o'clock at night. And your internet service provider didn't put enough capacity in to handle all that demand. And that's the real problem. So why the caps? If it doesn't help congestion, why the caps? Well, it's very simple. Because Comcast knew that the time was coming where more people would be watching movies on streaming via Netflix and iTunes and Amazon than would be watching premium channels on Comcast. And what they wanted to make sure is that you didn't do that. So they calculated. They got their little statisticians in the back room to figure out, well, if somebody starts to watch a lot of Netflix and starts to download a lot of movies from Amazon and Apple, how much bandwidth are they going to use? And suddenly 250 gigabytes doesn't seem like so much. It really doesn't. You could go through 250 gigabytes in 10 days easy if you started doing a lot of streaming. And, of course, as notice, Apple's offering 1080p downloads now. These are much bigger files. Netflix is offering 1080p now. These are much bigger files. So Comcast set this up a long time ago, knowing they were someday going to face this. And it's going to hit their bottom line, because how long before you stop subscribing to Comcast television to save $100 a month and just use the internet? That's called a cord cutter, and there's more and more cord cutters all the time. People who don't have cable TV, they only get their content from the internet. And that's where you're seeing this sudden jump in streaming movies. And if you talk to young people in particular, these are the people that really scare Comcast and AT&T and Charter and Time Warner, because the young people, they start out because they're young. They can't afford these $100 cable bills. They start out getting stuff only on the internet, and they never end up being cable customers at all.
We got a problem. We got a problem, Houston.
Stacy in San Diego, you're next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. Love your show. I always learn something every weekend. Wonder if you can help me with this. I have a teenage boy, and I'm looking
I can't
to,
help you. I'm sorry. I have a teenage boy, too, and there's no help for us. None at all.
I know. I'm ready to leave the keys and go, but I know I have to stay behind, so my only defense is to try to think smarter. So he's got a laptop at home, a PC, XPS, I think, Dell. And I wanted just to go behind the scenes and see what he's doing and what he's looking at. And, you know, 16, they're very curious, but very smart. So
yeah.
I don't want to put something in there that he's going to find out about.
He will find out. Is he?
Find out?
Yeah. Is he technically savvy at all?
Well, somewhat. I mean, you know, he's definitely better than me. So, but he's not one of those gadgety kind of cool guys. He's just where he is in terms of when he was born.
It's a little challenging. You know, I got a 17-year-old son and a 20-year-old daughter, and they grew up in this era, and There's the philosophical conversation of what's the best way to handle this. And in my opinion, unless you know your kid's getting in trouble, you know, once you know the kid's using drugs or getting in trouble in other ways, then I think as a parent, you have a responsibility to kind of keep an eye on them. But if they're just normal kids, I think kids do have, and this is purely philosophical. I'll answer your technical question, absolutely. But I think kids do have the right to some privacy. And so I think that you don't want to, you know, kind of start spying on your kid all the time. It's overwhelming anyway. There's far too much information. There certainly are solutions out there. You know, there's Cyber Patrol is an example. But most teenagers know how to get around these. And there's a lot of this information is passed around from teenager to teenager. There's even websites that tell them how to get around these tools because they don't want to be monitored. Here's what I would suggest, and this is what I used, and I think it's good. It's not a spy tool. It doesn't allow you to see what they're doing online. I wanted to respect my kids to this point. But it does kind of block some of the things you may not want them to be going to. It's open. It's free, and I love it. It's called OpenDNS. Go to opendns.com. And a lot of schools and businesses use OpenDNS. I use it at home. And you can tell OpenDNS what sites you don't want your kids to visit. You can keep track of what sites they do visit without watching them visit those sites. I think it's a perfect compromise for most parents. OpenDNS.com. So we were talking about spying on your kids. And, you know, I know this is a hot-button topic. And I am, as a parent of teenagers, I am very sympathetic and agree that a parent often needs tools to help them in this day and age. There are programs like Cyber Patrol, cyberpatrol.com, that will let you monitor what your kids do online or who, what, where. I'm not a fan of spying on your kids unless, you know, you really need to get in there and intervene. If there's a real problem going on, then maybe that's the time to do that. But what I would suggest, of course, substitute for communication. I would suggest you talk to your kids about, even at a very young age, about your policies about online use, what to do if they see something online that makes them feel weird or uncomfortable. You want to keep those lines of communication open. You don't want to create an adversarial system. You want to keep them talking. That's to be desired. Of course, by the time they're 16, sometimes there's nothing you can do. And I understand that. I'm very sympathetic. I do like OpenDNS, and I've used this since my kids were first getting online, I think when they were maybe 10 or 11. And it's nice because you can modify it as time goes by. So here's what this is. This changes DNS. Normally what you use when you're online, you use your internet service provider's name lookup. When your son wants to go to Playboy.com, he types in Playboy.com, and the internet service provider looks up the number and provides the number to the browser so that it can go there. It's just like a 411 for computers. You can replace this internet service provider DNS with OpenDNS. It's a free service. you'll do it. Usually you do it in the router. And the reason you want to do it in the router is because the kid can't get in. You password protect the router settings. Then the kid cannot change this, really. You may want to also lock down your computer so the kid can't change the network settings on the computer. And to be honest, if a kid is super, super sophisticated, he'll figure out other ways to get around this, including going to the neighbors or using his smartphone. But I think this is a good idea, and I put it on my system. So they have a parental control system where you can say what kinds of sites are blocked. A lot of schools use this. You could say, I don't want any gambling sites, any adult sites, no sites with violence. You can figure out what you want. As it turns out, it also has some useful tools for you. It has anti-fraud and phishing protection. It will speed up, in many cases, speed up your browsing because it's a little bit faster than your own internet service provider's DNS. They have a free home service, and then for $20 a year, you can get the full service. I think it's quite effective. Try the free service at first. And you can manually block sites. It blocked, for instance, and manually unblocked sites. When my daughter was young, she wanted to play a game called Neopets. She still does. She's 20, and she still does Neopets, which was just an online site where you had a pet and you'd create a store. It was a cute social site for little kids. And it was blocked by OpenDNS, but I could open it up and I could say, well, Abby's computer can go to Neopets. You have a lot of control. It also will show you all the sites that are visited and sites that have been blocked. So if your kid's trying to go to sex.com, it'll let you know, hey, I blocked sex.com at 8 o'clock last night. So I think that is sufficient. Windows and Microsoft Windows and Apple's OS X both have parental controls built in as well. If you have smaller children, I think a really good idea is to not do filtering and blocking because it's imperfect, but to do the opposite. Do an opt-in permission system where you say, these are the 5 sites you can go to. These are the people you can receive email from. That gives them an experience of the internet that is totally protected. They can only go to the sites that you allow. Again, OS X allows this. I believe Windows allows this. It's kind of appropriate for smaller kids. Once they get to, you know, teenage years, for school alone, they're going to need to get a little bit more wide access to the internet. But I think OpenDNS is a good solution. And just remember that no blocking system is perfect, that kids are smart. The more barriers you put up, the better they'll get at getting around those barriers. So there really is no substitute for talking to them. And if you're really worried about what they're doing online, have the computer in a public spot. Put the computer downstairs in the living room. Don't let them have a computer in the bedroom. Always best, I think, to do that kind of thing, to be proactive, to be involved, than to have to spy on them after the fact. And difficult to spy on them, to be honest. Let's see, moving along. Carl in Camarillo, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Carl.
Leo, great to talk to you.
Thanks for calling.
Hey, I've been listening to your show for a while. Really appreciate it. I've got a question about a Wi-Fi brick, you know, the little like deck of cards size thing that you can get from Verizon. It's a 4G brick that I bought last year.
Yeah.
It worked great for like the first 5 months that I had it. Then it started dropping the Wi-Fi signal. It wasn't broadcasting it anymore. And it was kind of intermittent. It kind of usually worked. And that percentage just kept going the wrong direction to where it usually wasn't working. And, of course, I'm going into business meetings with this website I just launched recently, trying to show the thing off and making sure I have a good connection and this thing's dying on
me. I just say get a new one. It sounds like it's broken. You know, if you think about it, these things they're small. There's a lot of heat going on in there. I'm not surprised to hear it might wear out.
Yeah, well, I went to a Verizon store, and they sent me a new one, a refurbished one, supposedly.
Yeah.
And I got it, and the same kind of thing was happening.
Yeah,
it,
frustrating.
You know? And it was very annoying. And so here's the real question is, I just got one of the new iPads. Now, that thing can tether as well, but you have to go to a Verizon store and get an account. I'm thinking of going to them and seeing if I can just transfer my account from that little brick that keeps
I'm sure you can. Yeah.
Because if I can do that, now the only downside, of course, to that is that it's not as small. I really like the iPad, the newest one, but you know the cool thing about the brick is you got it in your pocket.
They don't even know it's there. You just have magical internet.
Exactly. Yeah. So I really loved the brick size, but I just can't stand the difficulty.
Apparently, you know, yeah. According to Professor Messer in our chat room, there is a firmware upgrade for the MiFi that does improve this problem. So this is a known problem which they have attempted to fix. So I would check to see if you can update the firmware.
Okay, I'll look into that. Can I mention my website real quick? I just launched it last month.
Sure.
Yeah, it's TotalCarScore.com, TotalCarScore.com, and I just launched it because I was at Edmunds.com for 13 years as their editor-in-chief.
Oh, really? No kidding.
Yeah, and I left about a year ago, and I just launched this site, and it's basically Rotten Tomatoes for cars.
Brilliant.
You go to one site, and all the main scores from all the authoritative sites are in one location. And then I link to all the individuals, so you can still jump back and find all the individual scores if you want, and they're listed right there next to the car. But there's an overall score that I've converted, just done a data normalization into one score.
This is brilliant. Are you trying to raise money for this?
That's a great question. We're kind of oscillating. It's been me and another partner who was the main data guy that ran Edmunds data development for years. He and I started this with a third guy, and it's mostly been our own money, and we're surviving, but we haven't, we're trying to decide, okay, is it time to get serious about this? The traffic and the Google Analytics has been very positive. So people engage immediately once they find the site. It's really just an awareness thing. So
The Rotten Tomatoes model is a great model, and I bet you could raise money on this because you go to venture capitalists and say, one line, Rotten Tomatoes for cars. They get it immediately. Your background at Edmunds, which is one of the most prestigious car review sites out there, establishes immediate credibility. I got it immediately. Rotten Tomatoes. So the idea of Rotten Tomatoes, for those who don't know, is it aggregates reviews of movies, gives it a score, and it's either a Rotten Tomato or, I can't remember, it's a green tomato or a red tomato. And you know immediately, and plus it has user reviews. Hey, Carl, hang on, because I want to talk some more with you. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. What a great idea. Did we bring down the site? Good. There's something wrong with this song. Are you running at 78 again? Leo Laporte, the tech guy. That was weird. We're talking to Carl in Camarillo who has a classic idea. And this is kind of a little lesson in a startup. So it's one of the reasons I wanted to spend a little bit more, I hope you don't mind, a little more time with you, Carl. So Carl, you were editor-in-chief at Edmunds for how long?
I was there for 13 years. I was editor-in-chief for about 10 years.
Wow. And
I joined when there were 33 people. It's now like 500.
Now, I have to say, one of the things when you read a car magazine or you go to Edmunds, you always wonder, well, how editorially independent are these guys? Because they have ads for the companies that they're writing about.
Right.
So now that you're not there anymore, how editorially independent are these guys?
I had come from Peterson Publishing, which is now Source Interlink, before Edmunds. And one of the nicest things about going to Edmunds was how refreshing it was in terms of it's really feeling independent.
Good.
When I got there with 33 people and all, it was very much independent. Did it stay that independent throughout my 13 years? It was generally very independent.
You've said enough. We don't have to go any farther, Carl. And you and your buddy have left the company. And now... So you're both founders of this new place? By the way,
TotalCarScore.com.
Keep plugging it. We brought it down, so don't say it. There's no point in mentioning it anymore. You can't get there.
Okay.
I mean, literally, you can't get there.
You probably have crashed it, haven't you?
Oh, yes. We crashed it almost immediately. I was getting a MySQL error.
Seriously?
Oh, yeah.
Look at this. Now I'm trying to go,
no,
Leo,
you can't.
What'd you do to my site?
Dude, you come on a radio show and you mention a site like this, you're going to get some traffic.
It won't load. What did you do to my site?
I broke it. We do this all the time because I'll tell you, and it's not, I don't know who's hosting your site, but generally speaking, you don't pay for having 5,000 or 10,000 or 100,000 people hitting a site all at once. You can't afford that. Nobody can afford that except maybe Facebook and Google. So,
we
overwhelmed your site. You're not normally going to get that kind of peak traffic. But I tell you, it shows that there's some interest in this idea. So, and you have a perfect line. You're what they call the elevator pitch.
Elevator pitch, right?
The idea is you get in the elevator with John Doerr, the guy who has millions of money. He's an angel or a venture capitalist. He's got tons of money. He's dying to find a great company. You get in the elevator. You've got 15 seconds to tell John Doerr what your site is all about in such a way that he says, "Well, I'd like to know more." So, You got it. You got the elevator pitch. It's Rotten Tomatoes for cars. End of story. It's great.
And I couldn't believe it, Leo. I mean, I got to tell you, when it struck me, there was almost a cold sweat that broke out. Oh, God, someone's done that by now. And there was like about a 20-minute period of me searching the Internet. It was like, oh, my gosh.
You know
oh,
my God. Yeah, no, there's nobody. And you know who else is doing this, not for cars, but for gadgets? My friends Ryan Block and Peter Rojas, who used to be at Engadget. This very similar story. They used to be at Engadget, the great gadget blog. They started their own blog, GDGT.com, or Gadget. And they made a pivot. For the first year, they were like talking. It was a social site for people who said, I want this gadget, I like this gadget, with social reviews. They decided to do Rotten Tomatoes for gadgets. And so now if you go to Gadget, GDGT.com, what you'll see is their score plus an aggregation of all the scores from all the other gadget blogs. I think this is what people want, at least initially. You want kind of an over. Same thing. If you're going to a movie, you don't want to spend an hour reading reviews of the movie. You want a quick thumbs up or thumbs down. And you can do that at Rotten Tomatoes. You look at the tomato score, you go, hey, 86%. This must be a pretty good movie.
Leo, nobody sits down at a computer today and says, gee, you know what? I wish I had more information. That's what I want. Nobody does that. A lot of people sit down and say, gosh, you know what? I wish I had a way to filter all that information
exactly.
That's already out there.
Now, cars are a little different because I think before a movie is a quick, you know, you don't want to spend a lot of time before you go to a movie, but it's only $10. A car, you're spending a lot of money. You probably do want more information, but I think you also want to pare down the choices quickly to a handful that you can then research. So I think this is a great idea.
Well, if you know those scores are all coming from authoritative sites, if someone sits down with you and says, look, here's a stack of stuff I went through, and here's the answer on this sticky note, and you know I'm an expert, and you know these people are all experts in this stack. Most people are like, just give me the answer then, if that's the background that you've gone through. But some people are going to say, well, I want to go through that stack myself, especially on a big purchase. I got all the links. I've got all the direct. You go right to the, not just the home page of these sites, but to the very model page for there. So you aren't bouncing through all of their pathing to get to their model page. You go right from my, you know, Honda Accord page to their Honda Accord page for the same year, make, model.
So the next question John Doerr is going to ask you is, and how do you monetize?
And it's the same thing that most of these sites use. It's advertising and dealer leads.
There's actually a really good monetization point here, because even if you don't get ads, if you send a prospect to a dealer about to buy a car, there's some big bucks in that.
There's a third one, Leo, syndication. How many sites out there have a lot of great information on cars, but they don't have a nice encapsulated number that tells you how good or bad the car is according to the expert opinion?
Right.
How many sites out there could utilize some syndication?
Oh, very interesting,
Little total car score.
Or even dealers.
Exactly.
TotalCarScore.com says 83%.
Think of a dealer sales tool. You're out walking around the lot as a salesman, and you've got an iPad or some tablet with you, and you're walking up, and the consumer says, you know, well, I'm thinking of this car, but what about that car? Or I was going to come buy a Civic, but you guys are out of Civics. What about the Fit? Well, here, Total Car Score gives the Fit one of the highest scores.
I think you've got a tiger by the tail. I think this is a very good idea.
Well, I really appreciate it, and, you know, I'm just looking for trying to make
Now
sure
you know why people raise money, by the way.
Yeah.
For bigger
servers. All of a sudden, it was like, you know, I mean, well, we knew we might have to jump, you know, get in with the big boys and get some big money, but I think you just, with your list.
And you can say that. We mentioned it on the radio and the site went down. You know, you can mention that. I think that tells you there's some interest in it. Good luck, Carl. I think that's great.
Come back and give me another try when the site's back up after the mob has gone down. But I really appreciate your time, and thanks for the advice. Like I said, I think I'm going to get the iPad tetherable, and I'll just transfer that.
I think that's a great way to do it. Although, do check to see if your MiFi can be updated, because if there's new firmware that addresses that specific issue, that might really just fix it all for you.
Leo, can't thank you enough.
Good luck, Carl. It's rare. You know, I hear a lot of pitches for new ideas, new sites, and there's a ton of them. It's rare that you hear one that you go, oh, That's a guaranteed hit. What do you think? Do you think that's a guaranteed hit? Seems to me that's a pretty good idea. Then it's all about execution. We had we did an interview on Wednesday. I like to talk to founders. Entrepreneurs are fascinating people. They're gutsy. They're bold. They have vision. They're taking huge chances. It's a lot easier to, you know, take a 9-to-5 job and get a check, and a lot more risky to go out there and make your idea a reality. But what's great about the modern internet is you can do this fairly inexpensively. I'm sure Carl and his partner didn't spend a lot of money to get this site up and running. Proof of concept. Now the hard part comes, which is building a business, making it succeed. You know, raising the money is maybe easy compared to that. On Wednesday, I interviewed a woman named Leah Buskey, who, fascinating story, was a programmer at IBM, worked on Lotus Notes and Domino Server. And she and her husband were about to leave the house to go to a movie, and they realized they hadn't fed the dog, their 100-pound yellow lab, and they were out of dog food. And Leah said, "Oh, I bet there's somebody at the store right now who could just pick us up dog food if I could just figure out a way to contact them and say, just bring me the dog food. I'll pay you $5. And then a light bulb went on. She said, you know, that would be a really good, interesting business. If you had on your iPhone or your Android phone an application that said, I need somebody to come assemble this IKEA furniture, or I need somebody to shop for me. And then if there were people who were at the store who could be notified that they could just pick it up and bring it. She founded a company called TaskRabbit. TaskRabbit.com, which is exactly that. Now, they're not in every city yet. They're slowly rolling out. They started in Boston. They're in San Francisco, and they're slowly rolling out. And the way it works, you have the TaskRabbit app. You say, this is what I need. A TaskRabbit contacts you, and you arrange the fee, usually around $20. And they'll assemble the furniture. They'll clean the house. They'll wash your car, whatever it is you need to have done. She's raised over $20 million in venture capital on this idea. She's got a company of over 50 people in 2 years. So this is the world we live in. And there's a real opportunity. If you've got an idea and a vision and you've got the guts and the initiative to make it happen, you really can. It's pretty exciting. 8888-ASK-LEO, the website techguylabs.com. We've got everything on there. If you can't remember something I mentioned, or you're trying to find a link, techguylabs.com. Also a link there to the chat room, our live video, and the TwitNetcast Network. In fact, that interview with Leah Buskey is on our Triangulation show. That's up there as well at twit.tv. But you'll find it all at techguylabs.com. Hour number three still to come. You stay right here. I am Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Well, a good day to you, Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy, hour number three of the Tech Guy show. Taking your calls, talking high tech, 8888-ASK-LEO is the number. That's 888-827-5536, toll-free from anywhere in the U.S. And outside the U.S., use Skype out and call. You know I say that number fast, but you can always find it, the chat room, show notes, everything you need, including audio and video from past shows, at our website, techguylabs.com. You can remember that, right? Techguylabs.com. I don't ever tell anybody this, but there is a short URL for the Tech Guy Labs. It's leo.am. Isn't that good? Leo.am. I should use it probably. Leo.am is the Armenian registry. AM is Armenia. And I think I just renewed that for another 5 years or something. I love it. There's an FM, which I can't remember what FM is. There's .fm. .tv is Tuvalu, which is in the British Commonwealth. It's a little island in the South Pacific that's sinking, unfortunately. Fortunately, they're getting a little money from the .tv domain. 8888-ASK-LEO. Let's go back to the phones, and Naomi is next. She's in Denver, Colorado. Hi, Naomi.
Hi, Leo. Hey, Houston, I have a problem.
Oh, it seems to be the theme this week, isn't it?
It seems to be.
What's your problem, Naomi? What can I do to help?
I'm trying to make a wireless router system. I have a DSL modem. It's a Zizel PK500Z Wi-Fi modem router, and I want to have a wireless connection to another router in the basement. And the problem is I have to go through concrete because it's a concrete floor above it.
Yeah.
I can reach it. I can put the router down there, and I can see it coming in, but it can't talk to the DSL or the Wi-Fi router.
So you have DSL, and did the Zycel come from the DSL company, or is that yours?
Correct. It was, yeah. Uh-huh.
That's their provided gear. It is a Wi-Fi router as well as a DSL modem.
Correct.
Okay. And what you'd like to do is get the signal from that to another router in the basement? Why is that?
Because it's a concrete floor, and we can't drill through it. It's 8 inches of concrete plus offset rebar. And
you're saying that the Zycel is not powerful enough to get through the floor?
Correct.
Got it. So you want some way to get... It's in the basement because that's where the phone jack was? There was nowhere upstairs they could put it?
Well, I'm cutting the cord, and we're going with... We're starting with Roku and then maybe something else. Trying to get away from...
No, I like that, but I'm just wondering why they didn't put it in. You know, you could put in a DSL modem anywhere there's a phone line.
Yes, uh-huh.
So I'm wondering why they didn't put it upstairs.
Well, I've got the DSL modem router upstairs with the computer connected to it, but I want to get downstairs.
Ah, I get it. So it's working in the rest of the house. You just can't get a signal in the basement.
Correct.
Got it. I misunderstood. Yeah, you know, what you've basically created is what's called a Faraday cage. So turns out concrete isn't a big problem for DSL, not as much of a problem as the rebar in it. A metal mesh of any kind bounces the signals right off. So metal is the real problem on Wi-Fi. Lath, plaster, drywall, and even concrete, it'll kind of go through, but you're never going to get it through that rebar.
Yeah, because we have a corrugated sheet metal that holds the concrete up.
There
under.
You go, right there. Boing!
Metal I-beam.
Just bounces right off of that. So what we want to do is we want to somehow get the signal without drilling, as you say, without drilling a hole in the floor. We want to get the signal from upstairs down into the basement. Probably the best way to do that, you know, it is probably possible to go down through the walls. And if you get a contractor, you might want to try that. That would give you the best results. Just put a wire down through the walls. But if you don't want to do that, there is something called power line networking that often works quite well. And
it uses the
power lines in your house to transmit data.
Oh.
Now, so you'll get, when you get the power line networking unit, and a lot of companies make these, you'll get two ends. You get the end upstairs that plugs into the wall and that the Ethernet comes out of your modem and plugs into. And then you'll get one for the downstairs that plugs into the wall. Provided there's no junction box between those two, the data will transmit. If there's a junction box, all bets are off. That actually will stop the data. But
yeah,
most of the time, there's a junction box outside, but it doesn't, you know, it probably you can get from upstairs to downstairs with a straight shot. They need to be on the same circuit, in other words.
Plus down and...
Not a problem. The distance is not a problem.
Yeah, because this is an addition. One part of the house is an addition, so I don't know if they're connected.
If it has its own circuit breakers, if it has its separate circuit breakers, that won't work.
Ah, yeah, I think it does.
Okay, that's out. wow, you've got an interesting challenge. I think you're going to have to run a wire. It is attached, right? It's a basement of the house.
Correct. We added on to the original house because if we ever need to survive, we got the perfect house for it because it's a vault.
You got a bomb shelter.
Correct.
It's probably built in the 50s. Yeah. So unfortunately, that's one of the features of bomb shelters: no radio. I think you're going to probably want to put a hole in the wall and drop Ethernet wire down and come out.
Five.
Yeah. Cat 5, 5E. I would actually, if you're going to run it, run Cat 5E or Cat 6.
I can see the router. I can see the DSL modem router from upstairs. It's just a weak signal. I can actually try to connect to it, and sometimes it will and sometimes it won't. So it's getting an oscillator.
Well, there is a way to boost that. If you can put a router in between where you want it to be and where it is.
What I'm trying to do with this router. I have a router.
Yeah, you can do that, but it's called WDS, or Wireless Distribution System. Unfortunately, it was a very loose spec. So, you know, Wi-Fi works with everything because there's a pretty solid specification for it, and so any brand Wi-Fi device will work. But WDS, you generally want to get a WDS repeater that is of the same manufacturer as the original. Now, if the Zycel is the originating Wi-Fi... I don't know. I mean, Zycel is not not necessarily. They may make a WDS router. I'd look online. Otherwise, you might want to take the Ethernet out of the Zycel, put it into, say, an Apple Airport Extreme or some better Wi-Fi router, and then you could buy an Airport Express and extend it. So here's probably the best way to do this. First of all, the Zycel may not be the greatest Wi-Fi router to begin with. So buying an Airport Extreme, which is a very good Wi-Fi router, might solve the problem. It might just be enough juice to do it. It'll be 802.11, and it might even get through that wall. Since you say you're getting some signal, that's a good sign. But if it doesn't, then you buy the little $99 Airport Express. It plugs in anywhere. So anywhere you've got a plug, you plug it in, and you tell it, pass the signal along, please. And it will act as a repeater half midway between where you want to go and where you are.
Okay, and that's like about $100.
Well, yeah, unfortunately, the Airport Extreme is about almost $200. I think it's $180. But I'll tell you what, I know it's a lot more than, say, the cheap Linksys, but it's a lot better.
Okay, now the modem and the router are both G's. So
Will do a much better, much better job. G is not as good as N as far as getting around.
Right. An N would do better.
Yeah, so that's. I think this would be a big improvement. Is you know, you've got the Zycel, use it as a DSL modem only. Pass its signal via an Ethernet wire into an Airport Extreme. And then get the Airport Express halfway between. So the total cost, it's not cheap, is $300. But it will solve the problem, I believe. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Drill, baby, drill. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, Kyle Benham, our musical director, does it again. I'll tell you, if you like the music you hear in between on the show, you can get the playlist, the entire playlist, by following Kyle on Google Plus, Kyle space Benham, or just go to our show notes at the end of the show, and we'll put a Spotify playlist up there, too, so you can listen to all the crazy songs that Kyle plays, including that one. Ralph in Huntington Beach, California, you're next. Hi, Ralph. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. I recently got an LG Connect cell phone through Metro PCS, and I really like it. However, at my home, I get very poor reception, so I was wondering if you had any kind of a recommendation on a signal booster.
Yeah, I'm not sure about Metro PCS. I guess any signal booster would work with any carrier, so that's not the issue. Is there somewhere that you can get a signal in the area? I mean, can you? Could you? I'll give you an example. My local cell phone company, is an independent cell phone dealer, sells all the different phones. Decided he was going to move into a nice new space. He did, and then he found out that the back of the store didn't get any cell reception. Not an ideal situation for somebody selling cell phones. But he found that the front of the store did, so he bought I think he got a Wilson signal booster, put the antenna in the front of the store, and it sent it down to the back of the store, and problem solved. But in order for that to work, you've got to have somewhere in your area that you can get a signal that you control. Is this your, in the entire area is dead?
No, I get one or two bars kind of intermittently at my front door. I get a fairly decent signal, so I was thinking maybe an antenna on the roof would work great.
Okay, so Wilson Electronics is the stuff I'd recommend. They make a number of signal boosters. They probably make one that's appropriate for outdoor use. And you just put it on the roof, and it's exactly as you thought. It will boost it enough so that you can get, if you're getting decent connection you know, outside, then you send it down to the inside, and you should be fine. They're online at wilsonelectronics.com. You can at least read what their solutions are, but you can also find them. They're sold online for $50 to $100. They're not expensive.
Now, you previously you mentioned the power line networking. Would there be anything like that that would work as an antenna?
That's an interesting question. Possibly. I don't know of anything that does that. What the Wilson does is it just basically puts a cell site inside your house. So I think that's probably sufficient. I don't know if you need to use power line. You know, if you had, I don't know about Metro PCS. Other carriers, AT&T does this. They use something called a femto cell that is an interesting solution. Will connect to your broadband. and put, in effect, a little cell in your house. AT&T calls it a microcell. Other companies sell this. I would ask, I don't know if MetroPCS does. They may not, but I would ask MetroPCS, say, do you sell a femtocell solution? That's kind of interesting because it plugs into your broadband and turns your broadband into a cell site in your house. This is a good solution for people. AT&T has it. They call it their microcell, but this is a good solution for people who don't have coverage in the house at all. So that's another option. But I think, you know, if you're getting a decent signal on, you know, on the roof or outside, get the Wilson. It'll boost it sufficiently that you get 5 bars within the house. Vac in Tampa, Florida, coming up next. He's got a problem with his hard drive. It just won't work whenever he installs an operating system on it. We'll talk about what can go wrong with a hard drive and what to do about it in just a bit. But, of course, if you're having trouble with a hard drive, you probably want to talk about backing it up. Vac on the line from Tampa, Florida. Hi, Vac.
Hey, Leo. How are you?
I'm great. So you're saying you can't use your hard drive?
Well, let's see. I try. It's actually, it used to be my parents' computer, and before they bought, they're not too smart, not to, like, offend them with technology and stuff, but they actually got a new computer. They were looking to get one with Windows 7 anyways, since they have their opinions about Vista, like they don't like it and such. And so it was passed down to me, and when I actually tried to reinstall Vista on it, it had trouble installing, yeah. But whenever I tried to, like, load up 8 on it, it worked fine. However, the graphics and such went a little slow. So when trying the Vista install, I did a hardware diagnostic test on it, and it returned an error with BioHD-8.
Sounds like the hard drive is flaky, and even if you could get something else on it, I would not trust it. So what you want to do is kind of either get a new hard drive or recondition that hard drive. What happens with hard drives? You know, even a brand new hard drive has sectors on it. A sector on a hard drive is a portion of the hard drive in which you write data. They divide the hard drive up into sectors. Even brand new hard drives have bad sectors, sectors that cannot be written to. It's just part of the manufacturing process. You cannot make a perfect surface that can hold data everywhere on the surface. So when a new hard drive is made, they test it. And there is a map that's actually stored on the drive of bad sectors. And the hard drive tells the operating system you can't use these sectors. You can use anything else, but not these sectors. The problem is more sectors can go bad. Let's say it was marginal at the factory. The factory approved it, but now it's gone bad, especially older drives. As time goes by, more sectors fail. What you want to do is add those sectors to the bad table. Tell the operating system, don't use these. And in most cases, you can still use the drive, that all the good sectors are sufficient. There are some limited cases where an operating system has to write to, let's say, the master boot record on the hard drive. If you can't write to that, well, then you have to retire that drive. It's not going to work anymore. So the real problem is, how do we get these bad sectors added to the table? And unfortunately, the program that I use and recommend costs more than a new hard drive. So I'm guessing that you probably don't want to spend any money, Vac, but in case you do, the program you need is called SpinRite. It's from GRC.com. It will do exactly what I just said, map out the bad sectors, and most of the time, that's all you need to do. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888-ASK-LEO is the number. We're talking about hard drive and hard drive failures, and there's two kinds of hard drive failures. There's a physical hard drive failure, and that's really something you can't recover from. You know, the circuit board on the hard drive breaks, or the platter gets damaged. There's a little tiny floating head on the hard drive that reads, and if that gets bent, which it can, believe it or not, you're just out of luck. You can repair these, but only at great expense. There are companies like drivesavers.com, which is just down the road a piece. And they have a clean room. They have guys in bunny suits. They have parts for every hard drive manufactured. And so they have the facilities that they could literally open up a hard drive, take the platters out, put them in a new mechanism, seal it up again. You can't do that at home. You have to do it in a clean room environment. And it costs thousands and thousands of dollars. This is why I'm always harping about backup. If you have a physical problem with your hard drive, just kiss it goodbye, because unless you're willing to pay thousands of dollars, you're not going to recover that data. Fortunately, far more common are soft errors, these sector errors I was talking about, where hard drives working fine, except that there are a few little portions of the hard drive that aren't holding data very well. And it can be a source of a lot of common computer problems. It can slow your computer down because the computer may take more time to read the hard drive. You know, it doesn't give up right away. It'll try several times to read that data. Well, imagine it doing, 100 bad sectors and then having to read and read and read and read before it can finally get the data off of it. You can imagine how much that would slow your computer down. So it's possible for you to have a bad hard drive and not even know it. Just say, well, I don't know what's wrong with my computer. It's really slow. Or occasional crashes, because that sector is not really in a critical part, but it's important enough that every once in a while it can't be read, the computer crashes. So it's not unusual for, much more common, I'd say, than people realize, to have a bad hard drive. A program like SpinRite, which admittedly at $90, it costs more than a new hard drive in many cases, what it does is it goes, it's not a very complicated program. It's not very sophisticated. It just goes through your hard drive one sector at a time and keeps trying to read that sector. And it doesn't give up. Unlike the operating system, it just doesn't give up. It'll keep trying until it finally gets that data. And if it does get the data, it moves it. And then it says, this sector's bad. Don't read this. Don't put anything here anymore. So part of the problem with SpinRite is you don't know how long it's going to take. It could take an hour. It could take 4 hours. It could take 4 months. The longest I've ever heard is a year. Literally, somebody kept SpinRite running on a drive for a year until it finally finished, and then the drive was fine. Now, is that worth it? I don't think so, but unless there's something on that drive that you really need. This is why, believe me, backing up is always a better solution. But if you've got something on the drive and you really need it, that's one good way to do it. SpinRite doesn't care about file systems. It doesn't care about operating systems. It operates at a much lower level. It just tries to read the sectors, and it just doesn't give up. It just doesn't give up. And eventually, in many cases, you can read the sector. And in fact, if you find all the bad sectors, you map them out. Remember, all hard drives have bad sectors. This is adding a small percentage to the total hard drive space. Map those out. The hard drive is as good as new. It'll continue to operate. Something that could be a little more concerned about is a hard drive that's dying, that is losing sector after sector after sector. You'll know that because more and more of your data start disappearing. If that happens, don't even try to recover it. Just buy a new hard drive. In most cases, it's cheaper to buy a new hard drive than to try to fix the hard drive, especially if there's a hardware problem. Sam is in San Diego, or is it San and Sam Diego? I don't know. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Sam.
Hi, how you doing, Leo?
I am well. How are you?
Fine. All except for the frustrating spell check on Microsoft Word 2010.
What's happening?
Everything else is okay. It doesn't pick up errors.
So your spell check is not working.
Well, it picks up some misspelled words, but it doesn't pick up everything.
Really?
My wife's writing a book and for Kindle, and they recommend Word 2010. And she's proofreading, and it's frustrating.
All right, couple of possibilities, because in my experience, Word has a very good, very complete dictionary and should pick up most misspellings. Where it's going to fail is context-dependent spellings. If it can't tell the difference between your, Y-O-U-R, and your, Y-O-U, apostrophe, R-E. So those spellings, of course, no computer is going to be very good at that. But it should pick up, all misspelled words. If a word is misspelled, it should find it. It's got more than 100,000 words in the dictionary. So we know something's wrong. Couple of possibilities. First, check to make sure that you're using the U.S. English Dictionary. If you're using the French Dictionary, for instance, it'll pick up a misspelled restaurant, but it won't pick up most misspellings. So make sure you're using the right language that's in the settings. And if it still doesn't work, I would reinstall Word. I would just reinstall it. Make sure that you got the full dictionary copied over. Reinstalling it will just replace it. My dad had a similar problem. He called me. He said, "Where's the custom dictionary?" I said, "Why do you want the custom dictionary?" He said, "Because the spell check is not working." I said, "No. You just probably don't have the full install on there. So reinstall it. Make sure you get the dictionary. You know, when you install Word, there's a bunch of check boxes. I would check and make sure that you've got the right dictionary installed. And I suspect that's all it is. It's either you've chosen the wrong dictionary by accident, or it's not fully installed. But it should absolutely work. I use Word all the time. It has a very big vocabulary and rarely misses a misspelling. Donald in Carpinteria, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Donald.
Hello, Leo.
Welcome to the show. What can I do for you?
Actually, I have a comment as well as a question. A comment about yesterday's. Well, there was a caller yesterday from the real estate agency, I guess, and he wanted display signs. I worked the tech department for the Southern California Linux Expo.
Oh, Scale is a great event. I love that.
It is. Yeah. And last year I installed a system. It's an open source project called Xibo, X-I-B-O, and it's digital signage. It lets you address individual screens as well as groups of screens. So, for example, you can have the group of screens in the window that show photos and video, and the group of screens behind the counter that shows, you know, tour package pricing and stuff.
What a great idea. Of course, it makes sense that Scale would use an open source solution, xibo.org.uk.
Yes.
Now, you'd buy your own screens and you'd be running it. Does it run on Windows or do you need to use Linux?
It runs on Windows. It can pull in data from RSS feeds.
Oh, so, you know, that's cool.
Plane arrivals and departures, travel news, weather. It can even do photos, videos. It can play videos. It can play PowerPoint presentations. It's pretty full-featured.
That is really cool. What a great idea. So basically any content that you want to get up there, you can, and it'll automate
right.
it. I love that.
It's got an easy-to-use web interface, so anybody can update it at any point.
X-I-B-O, Xibo. Thank you for that tip. I really appreciate it, Donald.
No problem. Now, my question, I've called in before. I run the Otaku no podcast, anime podcast.
Oh, yes.
Yes, and so when I do videos, I want to start using a teleprompter, not, you know, because I have a really bad memory.
Hang on, we'll talk about it. We got to take a break, but I will help you with that, Donald. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
That woman don't know what she's talking about. It's all about me.
I don't know where you find these.
Obama.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy, the robot president. 8888 Ask Leo, last segment. We were talking about teleprompters. Donald in Carpinteria has a podcast, the Otaku No podcast, and I thought it was audio, so you're doing video too now, huh?
I do some video episodes as well, yes.
Good for you. That's awesome. So, yes, it's very hard to memorize your text, isn't it? It's much easier to use a teleprompter.
I actually have an iPad, and I have a program called ProPrompter that works quite well. My problem, though, is how do I mount the thing to my tripod?
Right.
I looked on Amazon, and I found a couple of tripod mounts, but they actually replace the tripod head, which means I need to have a second tripod.
Where does the camera go? Here's the problem. Here's the problem. If the teleprompter is off the camera axis, it's going to be looking like you're not looking at the camera.
Exactly.
And that's goofy. So the way teleprompters work, whether it's the president's teleprompter or one in a television studio, is they essentially use one-way glass. So one-way mirrors, rather. So we've all seen pictures of politicians speaking, and they have in front of them they have glass panels that are tilted at an angle. Well, the angle is such that they're actually acting as mirrors, bounce, and below them is a computer screen. And it's bouncing off of that glass because at an angle it reflects, but if you look at it, you can go straight through it. So Burke is now bringing me our teleprompter from our studio. And this is essentially how they work in a television studio. You have a computer screen, which, by the way, has to display the text backwards, doesn't it? Because it's going to be bouncing off a mirror. And the camera is on the other side of a one-way mirror. The camera can look straight through it. It does darken the picture a little bit, so you get a slightly darker picture. But the talent, the hosts, are actually seeing the display reflected into this. So they're reading the display and looking at the camera at the same time. So it works quite well, and this is how every television news studio works. When you're on a teleprompter, it looks like you're looking at the text, but for the people on the other side of the camera, it looks like you're looking straight at them. The only trick on this, and it's not easy, is to not look like you're reading. If you're using one of these things, your eyes go back and forth like you're reading, then that looks even more shifty. Reading a prompter is actually an advanced skill. Thanks, Burke. I appreciate it. So that's our. Now, we spent a lot of money on these things. They're almost $1,000 each, I think. Yeah? 500? It's all about the mount. It's exactly what we were talking about with Donald. It's all about the mount. So you can go to B&H Photo or other places, and you can find a mount that we'll use to take an iPad. We decided not to get the iPad ones because the truth is an iPad is more expensive than a cheap 16-inch display. Right? You know, you don't really need the iPad. You just need a display that you can control by either turning a knob or scrolling a mouse or whatever. There are even websites, qprompter.com, that will do all of the backwards slow scroll text. You just need to put that on a screen and then bounce the screen up against a mirror into the talent's eyes. So all of the expense, it's not the software. It's not even the display. It's not the iPad. It's getting this mount that will sit in front of a camera so that you can look through the camera or look through the prompter at the camera. And frankly, for a podcast, it's prohibitive. You know, I went kicking and screaming. I did not want to buy these teleprompters. It wasn't the money. I never use a prompter if I can avoid it. I hate teleprompters because it makes you feel canned. It makes you look like you're reading. It gets in between you and communication. So I'm not a big fan of them anyway, Donald, but we got these we do a gaming show and we actually had to hire talent. And talent apparently requires teleprompters. And the truth is, once you're hiring talent, the cost of a teleprompter is nothing. Now, for you, Donald, I know you don't want to memorize. What I would suggest is, if you can avoid using a prompter, do just kind of ad-lib it, edit it, whatever you need to do. But mounting this thing on a tripod, if you really want to, I'm looking at B&H Photo. They have an iPad mount. It's called the AutoQ. Are you ready for this? $1,148.
Ouch.
And then, by the way, just as you thought, it takes up the tripod. You need a second tripod with a camera on it. It's just not worth it.
Yeah.
Learn your lines, Donald. That's my suggestion. Otaku No Podcast is OTAKUNO.com. Is that right?
That's got it. You got it.
Yeah. I don't know of any inexpensive way to do it. You know, it's funny when you go see David Letterman or Conan O'Brien or Jay Leno, they don't use teleprompters, do they? They use white cue cards and a guy holding them. That's even more expensive. You got to hire a guy who's got very good penmanship. But, you know, that might be a good solution for you if you can get an intern or somebody, is instead of trying to put it, it's very hard to scroll it at the right pace and all that. Just have somebody write notes on big white shirt cardboard and hold it up below the camera. It works for Letterman. It works for Leno. It should work for the Otaku No Podcast. That's my opinion. We're going to take a break, come back and talk to Chris in Miami. He wants to test his Wi-Fi signal. I've got some great apps for you that are very, very useful, and I'll tell you why you might want to use them.
Really? Me too. Yeah, it's about 80 degrees down here.
Oh, shut up. It's pouring rain and about 53 degrees in California. What's wrong with this picture?
A lot. I used to live in California, actually, from 1979 to 1986, and then I moved back to Boston.
Ah, you sound like you might be from the East Coast originally, yeah.
Yeah, I'm originally from New York, Syracuse, New York.
That sounds right. So I got about a minute. You want a Wi-Fi analyzer.
I need something because I'm on AT&T UVerse, and they want me to keep running this speed test, and I just don't think it works. I need something more like a meter where I can have one on my iPhone, upcoming iPad, and my Mac, where I can actually see not just a speed test, but actually to see exactly what is going on when I go from room to room, and why is it dropping off in my master bedroom while I'm in my kitchen.
Yeah.
And I'm getting great.
Yeah, that's a Wi-Fi issue, absolutely, okay. And there are some very good Wi-Fi tools. I use one on Android that I think is also available on iPhone.
Okay.
It's called, but you know, you could just search for this one. I mean, it's got a very generic name, Wi-Fi Analyzer. But what it does is it'll give you a graph. It'll show you all the Wi-Fi channels and show you what kind of activity is going on each as it's going on. And it is a very useful tool for figuring out where there are problems because, frankly, it's pretty crowded out there right now, especially in the cities. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Have a great geek week.